Got it, man. I'm ready.
Our response here at The Takeaway to the events of the past year is to explain, to seek truth, to call out where we see abuse and exploitation, to strike down where we see hubris and falsehoods. And we think that our best response to the political events of this year is vigilance. This is something New York Daily News columnist Sean King practices daily with his social media presence and active Facebook commentary. And we've come to admire his relentless pursuit of justice around the corner and around the world. Listen now to the vigilance of Sean King in his own voice and words, 2016.
January 11th. I'm sorry to put this on you, but my calling is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. Babies in Madaya, Syria are starving to death. 5 confirmed casualties today. Despicable. January 20th. The funeral program of 16-year-old Janiyah McMillan died in police custody on January 11th in my home state of Kentucky. Still no real answers. March 23rd. I need you to see this. This is outrageous. This was a polling line yesterday in Maricopa County, Arizona.
This is designed to suppress the vote.
People waited for hours and hours and hours to vote. Some, as you can imagine, just had to leave to go to work or pick up their kids, etc. The state drastically cut the number of polling locations down from well over 200 to just 60. April 24th.
Tell me the reason why.
Man kicked out of Donald Trump rally for no reason other than being black. Police don't even deny it. May 19th.
Every case of police brutality against a Negro follows the same pattern. They attack you, bust you all upside your mouth, and then take you to court and charge you with assault.
Sharing this short, powerful clip of Malcolm X on his birthday, it's painful how true what he says here remains true to this very day. Happens almost every day in this country.
And it will never be stopped until we stop it ourselves.
June 3rd, bigots say bigoted things. Case in point, Donald Trump points out a black man in the audience at his rally, and in a possessive tone like he was talking about a damn slave says,
"Look at my African-American over here. Look at him."
Yeah, that was the end of the sentence. Not my African-American friend or my African-American homie, but my African-American. Yeah, that man is the Republican nominee, and it's actually 2016. June 24th.
Are you going to vote for Hillary Clinton in November?
Yes.
You knew this day was coming. I know it stings and it's a bitter pill to swallow. It is for me. If you think it's hard for you, please understand how much harder it is for Bernie to be in this position. Our values, our priorities, our principles, our positions, they are all too important to simply drop and move on. July 30th.
She came at me with those scissors.
Police shoot and kill this petite Navajo woman. Her name is L'Oreal Tensing. She was a shoplifting suspect. Notice that he manhandled her repeatedly before this. This is despicable. In any other developed country, this woman would still be alive. September 19th, the brutal Tulsa police murder of Terrence Crutcher. He was peaceful. His hands were up. Then he is murdered in cold blood and left to die alone. September 25th, I'm furious. This man, Robert Pittenger, is a United States congressman. He literally said protesters of police brutality, quote,
"They hate white people because white people are successful and they're not."
This is not just offensive, it's dangerous. This man is a lawmaker. November 27th. I don't think I will ever fully adjust to Donald Trump as president of the United States. It's just so utterly damn ridiculous. November 30th. President Obama has actually done a pretty good job as president at hiring a truly diverse staff. From cabinet positions all the way down to interns, he has attempted to build a team that looks like America. Unfortunately, he has less than 2 months left in office, and most of that diversity will be flushed down the toilet. December 4th. I must say this. Indigenous people stopped the Dakota Access Pipeline. Don't get it twisted. Liberal activists supported the efforts, no doubt, but the heart and soul of what happened in Standing Rock was driven by local people who put their lives on the line. All protest of injustice must be driven by local people, and local people must get the credit and love for the victories.
As you can hear from his voice in the previous segment, Sean King is not afraid to disrupt the smooth pond of the status quo in the pursuit of what he calls social justice. His bold statements and initiatives have given him a large audience and lots of reaction. He's the senior justice writer for the New York Daily News and remains an activist in the Black Lives Matter movement. Earlier this month, on the 61st anniversary of the launch of the Montgomery bus boycott, he launched the Injustice Boycott, an organized resistance, he says, against racial injustice and police brutality in the United States. Is it working? Well, it's all part of the high decibel accountability that King brings to his work. This year, he's been tracking the number of hate crimes, people killed by police, and those who are currently incarcerated, and he compares those stats to create an index for comparing conditions today with conditions years ago. And King says the number of people in jail today overwhelms the data from even much more violent periods in America's past.
If we look at previous generations, we had about 200,000 people who were incarcerated in this country. Now we have 2.5 million. Last year, there were 1,208 people killed by police in this country. That's the highest number ever recorded. And we believe that that is the highest number of people ever killed by police in any given year. And so in some ways, this country has improved, but in other ways, we have fallen back and gotten worse.
Let's take apart the incarceration figure first. There does appear to be a consensus to reform sentencing and to change and address the consequences of the law and order approach to crime in the 1980s. Do you think that's going to go anywhere?
I don't. I think we were building something that felt like a consensus. But Donald Trump, in every public way, has said, hey, I am the law and order president. And he was kind of roundly endorsed by the Fraternal Order of Police, the national organization, many of the local organizations. And they are very publicly against those very basic reforms, sentencing reforms, and the basic justice reforms that we thought had bipartisan support. A lot of the people who support Donald Trump don't support them. And so I feel like we're at a point where we had a lot of potential, but I get the hunch that we've squandered that potential.
Even the fiscal realities aren't going to drive this. Republicans, particularly in Texas and Oklahoma and other places in the traditionally Republican South, have said this doesn't work, this building prisons, this prison industry. We have to fundamentally do something different. And even if you don't look at the incarceration figures, but just look at the people who are dropped back into society with like just bus fare, they're seeing the consequences of this. There's kind of no way to avoid this.
Yeah, well, I hope you're right. And, you know, most change, particularly over these next 4 years, is going to be local change. And most people who are incarcerated in local jails or state prisons. And so we need to go local. And that's what I'm doing. I'm focusing on city governments where we often have so-called progressive mayors in office, state governments, state houses. And I think there's a lot of progress that could be made in California, in New York, in cities like Portland and Seattle, Atlanta and Charlotte. And we haven't focused very much on holding progressive and democratic local governments accountable. And I think now we're going to be going local way more than we ever have.
Let's talk about the police for a moment. A lot of people who criticize you say that you come down on the police inappropriately. And Ta-Nehisi Coates, for instance, suggests that the police are the carriers of a permission that once existed to attack black bodies.
Yeah.
And that unless you explicitly turn that off, turn that permission off, it's on. It's sort of not their fault, but they're a reflection of something. I mean, it may be their fault. It may not be their fault. But in other words, there's no way that's not going to happen unless you explicitly turn it off. Do you buy that idea?
Yeah. I agree with that completely. And it's a beautiful analysis by Ta-Nehisi in that unless people are held accountable. And here's the thing. I fully agree, and I've said this publicly. It just doesn't trend or get shared. I do believe that most police are good people and most police do a great job. But when we're talking about 10 to 15% of police who may bend the rules, who may be more brutal than the 80 to 90% of their counterparts, we're still talking about tens of thousands of incidents of brutality all across the country every year. And it's brutality that doesn't exist in the same form in any developed country in the world. And we have to ask ourselves, why are our police so brutal in ways that they aren't in other places? And Ta-Nehisi is right. Police feel like they have permission for very good reason. And it's because even in the most egregious cases, be it the shooting death of Amadou Diallo or in so many other instances, police still get off. And so,
and history stalks. History is the ghost.
Yeah, it is.
America's violent history is in the background.
Absolutely, man. And, you know, so I compare, when I speak across the country, I compare the problem of modern-day police brutality to the epidemic of lynching in previous generations, and that the brutality of police, for all intents and purposes, replaced the lynching of a previous generation. So if we look at it, we would have to go back. Last year in 2015, 102 completely unarmed black men, women, and children were killed by police. We would have to go all the way back to 1902 to find a single year in American history where that many black folk were lynched in this country. And that's just the men and women who had no knives, no guns, no weapons, many of them no criminal records, in instances where brutality was avoidable, but police served as judge, jury, and executioner, much in the same way that we saw lynching, particularly in the 1890s and early 1900s.
Is the reason for that, and you've sort of partially answered this, is the reason for that that police are out of control, or that we haven't addressed as a society that period of time in our history, that Jim Crow lynching period? We talk a lot about slavery. We talk a lot about the Underground Railroad and those sorts of things, but we really don't deal with that early 20th century terrorism moment, and that's the ghost that lives today.
It is the ghost of America in so many ways, and no, we haven't addressed it in any substantive way. And in a lot of ways, the way we do race in America is we say, we got over that, let's move on. And I think we have greatly exaggerated and overestimated what we've gotten over in this country. But police brutality is actually an incredibly complicated problem. I wrote a 25-part series on how we address and solve issues of police brutality. And what I never said publicly, because I thought people would almost laugh at it, is behind the scenes, I wrote out almost 100 reasons, you know, that really feed this monster of police brutality. And I had to kind of pare it down to 25 different ways, 25 different issues that kind of feed this monster. And so it's an incredibly complicated problem. And social media, I will admit, doesn't do a great job at dissecting the complicated nature of this problem or any problem. And so when we reduce a problem to a tweet or a Facebook post, we've often grossly oversimplified it. And that's the case with police brutality.
Do you think that there is an argument over who gets to be mad about racial injustice in America?
Well, I don't think there's a legitimate argument over who gets to be mad, but it's so complicated that it's very easy to unknowingly step on people's toes or say something insensitive unintentionally or wade into an issue that you may have never experienced, but then still talk about it with a degree of authority that ends up really irritating people who have experienced it. And so when I speak around, I speak at colleges all around the country, and one of the first questions I get every single time is, "Hi, Sean, I'm white and I'm deeply bothered by racial injustice. What do I do and how can I talk about it?" And my answer to that is always, first and foremost, listen more than you talk. And if you're going to fight for racial justice, be willing to survive the awkward moments, the moments where people that you feel like you're fighting for may be disappointed in something you've said and done. Be willing to wade through the difficult and challenging discussions that are sure to happen, and that will help kind of buy the loyalty of the people you're fighting for. But what a lot of black folk have found is that sometimes when these conversations get messy, a lot of people they thought were their allies check out and move on. And black folk don't have the ability, people of color or women who are fighting for their rights, don't have the ability to not be a woman, to not be black, to not be oppressed. And it's sometimes discouraging on a level that people who don't experience that oppression struggle to understand, to see people you thought were fighting for you walk away and move on. And it can hurt.
So the important thing for people who claim or have experienced more white privilege than black oppression to be vigilant.
Oh, yeah.
The idea is that if we're all equally vigilant, or if we're all significantly vigilant, we can put this away.
Yeah.
But if only one group is paying attention, we'll never make progress.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And to double down on that sentiment, there is this notion about race and racism in America that even though it is rather widely accepted that black folk are the primary recipients of racism, by and large, black folk are also the primary people expected to fix the problem. And that's just not how it works. And so what a lot of us are looking for are for people who aren't a part of that oppressed group, whatever situation that is, to fight for that problem with the people you have influence over. And often we see something peculiar where we see white men or women fighting against racism, but doing it sometimes with a primarily black audience. And what we're hoping is that influential white men and women will speak more about issues of race and racism and discrimination, oppression to primarily white audiences and to influence the people who may be more likely to be racist.
Sean King, senior justice writer for the New York Daily News. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you, man.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.